So imagine sitting on your couch, scrolling through an app.
Right, just a normal evening.
And you find a TV for $499. You think, yeah, that's a good deal. I'll take it.
Sounds perfectly reasonable.
So you decide to go buy it. You get in your car, drive all the way to the store, and pull into the parking lot.
Okay, I think I know where this is going.
You check the app one more time just to confirm the aisle number, and bam, the exact same TV is suddenly $100 more expensive.
Wow. And that's all because the app tracked your GPS location, right?
Exactly. It realized you had physically arrived at the store.
It knew you were already invested. It instantly recalculated your willingness to pay on the spot.
And that single algorithmic decision, it actually ended up costing the company a $5 million fine.
Because it crosses a major, major line.
Welcome to the invisible, incredibly lucrative world of online pricing. We've all experienced that universal digital groan, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely.
You hesitate on a flight or a hotel room, you hit refresh, and the price just jumps.
It feels personal.
It really does. It feels like the internet is actively watching you. And today, we are taking a stack of research to find out if it actually is.
And the distinction we really have to draw today is between traditional supply and demand economics and something far more invasive.
To do that, we're pulling from a fascinating array of sources. We've got recent reporting from Gizmodo and The Guardian.
Some really great investigative journalism there.
Definitely. Plus a data-heavy investigation by Mighty Travels. A deeply unsettling report from Consumer Watchdog, findings from the Federal Trade Commission, and some brand new legislative texts out of Maryland.
So a full stack for this deep dive. By the end of this, you'll understand the critical difference between standard dynamic pricing, which reacts to the market, and surveillance pricing.
Which reacts specifically to you.
Exactly. Understanding that difference is really the only way to navigate the modern digital storefront without getting completely taken advantage of.
There is a recent, highly public incident that perfectly captures this paranoia we all feel.
The JetBlue thing.
Yes. It involved an incredibly frustrated user on X, formerly Twitter. They go by the name Nug.
Right, Nug. And they tweeted at the airline because a flight they were looking at jumped $230 in a single day.
And it's for a funeral, too.
Oh, man. That is a brutal price hike, especially when you are booking under that kind of emotional duress.
Exactly. But the real story wasn't the price jump itself. It was JetBlue's official response.
Which was, frankly, shocking.
Yeah. Their social media account replied with a tip. They suggested the user try clearing their cash and cookies or, you know, booking using an incognito window.
They basically repeated the exact folklore that travel forums have been passing around since the early 2000s.
Right. I read that and immediately thought of a car salesman.
How so?
Like accidentally confessing that they run out to the lot and hide the cheaper price tags the second they see you looking interested in a sedan.
Oh, right. Yeah, coming from the airline itself, it felt like an admission of guilt.
It totally did. And the internet exploded. JetBlue quickly deleted the tweet, and they issued an apology, claiming a crew member made an error.
Right. They stated definitively that their fares are not based on cached data or your personal information.
But you can't put that genie back in the bottle. A New York resident named Andrew Phillips actually filed a class action lawsuit based on this.
Claiming what, exactly?
Claiming JetBlue violated wiretapping and consumer protection laws.
Wow. I mean, it looks like a smoking gun. But if we look at the actual data infrastructure behind airline ticketing, the truth is a lot more nuanced than an airline tracking your cookies to punish you.
So they aren't tracking us.
Well, the Mighty Travels investigation actually put this to the test. They ran 2,000 separate flight searches across 6 major airlines to see if the cookie theory holds up.
I would assume the clean browser won, but given how persistent this rumor is, it should have been a complete landslide.
It wasn't a landslide, but a clean browser, meaning one wiped of all search history and cookies, did find lower prices about 59% of the time compared to a browser loaded with tracking cookies.
Okay, so the paranoid internet forums are right. They are tracking us.
Not quite. And this is where the mechanism really matters. When you dig into that 59%, those lower fares almost entirely came from online travel agencies.
Like the middlemen.
Yeah. Places like Orbitz or Expedia, not directly from the airline's own websites.
Oh, I see.
Experts in the travel industry, like Katie Nastro at Going and Sophia Lin at Google, point out that clearing your cookies to lower flight prices directly with an airline is basically a myth.
But if the airline isn't reading my cookies, why did that flight jump $230 when the user refreshed the page? Something caused that number to change.
It has everything to do with how server caching works. Think about the sheer volume of flight searches happening globally every single second.
It's got to be millions.
Exactly. If the central reservation system had to calculate a brand new real-time price for every single query, the servers would crash instantly.
So what do they do instead?
To save computing power, the system holds onto a ghost price, a recently cached price, and shows you that first. When you hit refresh, or when you actually go to click buy, you force the system to do a hard pull for the live inventory.
So the airline isn't raising the price because you looked twice.
No, they are just finally showing you the reality of their current inventory.
So it's not malice, it's just server efficiency. The system was essentially feeding me outdated information on the first search to save its own bandwidth.
Exactly.
But that still leaves a huge question. If my cookies aren't driving the price up, what is? I always just assumed a plane was one big block of seats, but the sources keep referring to something called fare buckets.
Fare buckets are the absolute foundation of airline pricing. They don't just assign one single price to a coach seat. They divide the cabin into invisible tiers. So the first 10 seats might be in the lowest priced bucket. Once those 10 are purchased, that bucket is closed, and the system automatically bumps the price up to the next bucket.
That sounds exactly like buying concert tickets.
Yes. Perfect analogy.
The front row or the early bird specials sell out immediately. So yeah. You are forced into the next tier of seating, and the price just keeps getting steeper the closer you get to the show date.
Right. Regardless of who is buying the ticket. It is a completely blind mechanism based entirely on inventory depletion. But it moves incredibly fast.
How fast?
Well, according to the data we reviewed, American Airlines operates a dynamic pricing engine that is evaluating over 100 different variables constantly.
Like what?
We're talking about weather patterns, competitor pricing on parallel routes, and decades of historical booking data. They can adjust the price of those fare buckets up to 7 times a day.
That's roughly every 3 hours.
Exactly.
Okay, I follow the supply and demand logic there. But the sources also noted that airlines are using IP addresses.
Yes, they do.
They use your location to establish a baseline price, meaning wealthier zip codes might see higher starting prices. I had to push back on the idea that this is completely blind.
Why is that?
Well, if a corporation uses my IP address to determine I live in a high-income neighborhood and charges me more because of it, that feels highly personal.
The line definitely gets blurry there. But legally and mechanically, airlines classify this as standard dynamic pricing. It is cohort pricing, not individualized pricing.
So they're looking at a group, not a person.
Right. They are looking at a regional economic model. The algorithm determines that a specific geographic market can bear a higher baseline cost, but crucially, it is not looking at your specific identity.
It doesn't know my name.
It doesn't know your bank account balance, your personal credit score, or your individual shopping habits. It just knows the median income of your zip code.
So dynamic pricing is fundamentally looking at the crowd. They're reacting to a demographic, maybe throwing in some psychological pricing like charging $199 to trigger an impulse buy, but they aren't looking directly at me.
Correct. But there's a huge difference between reacting to crowd behavior and reacting to your specific personal vulnerabilities, which brings us to the much darker side of the digital economy.
This is where we cross the line into true surveillance pricing. And the examples in the research are genuinely unsettling.
They really are.
This isn't about how many seats are left on a plane. This is a system designed to figure out the absolute maximum amount of money you are uniquely willing to part with before you walk away.
Noah Gian-Siracusa from Harvard Law calls this information inequality.
Information inequality. I like that term.
Historically, when you bought something, the buyer and the seller had roughly equal footing. You could haggle, you could walk away. But today, because of the sheer volume of data collected on us, that balance of power has completely collapsed.
Companies are actively searching for your unique individual pain point.
Precisely.
And regulators are finally starting to see under the hood of how this works. The Federal Trade Commission recently released findings from a 6B study.
And for context, a 6B study is incredibly powerful.
Right. It allows the FTC to legally compel corporations to hand over their internal, highly guarded documents.
And their data, without actually having to file a lawsuit first, they essentially get to demand the blueprints of how these algorithms function.
What do they find?
What the FTC found is that a whole ecosystem of middlemen, third-party tech firms hired by major retailers, are tracking granular behavioral data.
So they aren't just looking at your zip code?
No, much deeper. They're tracking the speed of your mouse movements on a web page.
Wait, really? The speed of my mouse?
Yeah. They are analyzing the specific items you put in your digital cart and then abandon. They feed all of those micro behaviors into an algorithm to calculate exactly how hesitant or desperate you are.
And then they just tweak the price on the screen accordingly.
Exactly.
Let's look at the Consumer Watchdog report, because seeing the actual mechanisms these companies use is wild. We mentioned Target earlier, the geofencing example.
Right. A user looks at a TV on the Target app at home, $499. But the app is tracking their location permissions.
And when they cross into the parking lot?
The algorithm recognizes a profound shift in behavior. The customer is no longer passively browsing. They have committed time and gas to physically travel to the location.
Their willingness to walk away has plummeted.
So the app automatically refreshes the price to $599.
Because they know you are already there and probably won't leave empty-handed over a price discrepancy you might not even notice.
It's incredibly sneaky.
And it's not just retail. The telematics programs in the insurance industry are doing something very similar, but over a much longer timeline.
Oh, yeah. These are the tracking devices or apps you install in your car to supposedly earn a safe driver discount.
The premise sold to consumers is that if you brake smoothly and follow the speed limit, your premium drops.
But the Consumer Watchdog report detailed how Allstate was using this data to implement a loyalty penalty.
A loyalty penalty? That sounds like an oxymoron.
It does. Over a decade, they overcharged their safest California customers by over $1 billion.
Wait, how does being a safe driver lead to a penalty?
Because the algorithm wasn't just measuring driving safety, it was measuring behavioral elasticity.
What does that mean?
The telematics data helped them determine which customers were highly loyal, passive, and unlikely to endure the friction of shopping around for a new insurance provider.
So if you aren't a complainer, they target you.
Basically, once the algorithm flagged you as a sticky customer, they slowly, incrementally raised your rates. They mathematically determined they could squeeze you for more money without you leaving.
It's penalizing you for trusting them. And the data they use could be incredibly arbitrary. The sources showed they were penalizing drivers simply for driving late at night.
Right, which heavily impacts certain demographics.
Yeah, if you're a third shift worker, a nurse, or someone working multiple lower income jobs that don't fit a standard 9-to-5 schedule.
The algorithm inherently views your life as a risk factor and charges you more.
That is just deeply unfair. And what about the Orbitz example?
Oh, that one is fascinating. Orbitz found that Mac users tend to spend more on hotels.
So they just showed them higher prices.
Yep, straight out of the gate. And Princeton Review did something even more controversial. They charge higher test prep prices to customers in zip codes with higher Asian
Are
populations.
you kidding? That is straight up demographic targeting.
It really is. And then you have Staples. They charged more for a stapler online if the user was not located near a competitor's physical store.
Oh, so if you don't have an Office Max nearby, they know you're trapped.
Exactly. Rideshare companies have explored these psychological vulnerabilities too.
I've definitely felt that surge pricing pain.
Well, Uber actually hired a data scientist who published research showing that users are far more willing to accept a high surge price when their smartphone battery is critically low.
Oh, man. That makes complete sense from a human panic perspective.
Yeah.
If you are standing outside a bar at 2 a.m. and your phone is at 2%.
You aren't going to spend 10 minutes comparison shopping on Lyft.
Exactly. You're going to click accept on whatever price gets you home before your screen goes black.
Now, Uber formally denies that they use battery life to actively set prices today.
Yes. But the fact that their internal researchers were analyzing it tells you everything you need to know about the metrics they consider valuable.
It is entirely about leverage. The Harvard Law piece brought up this fascinating concept of the digital twin.
Right, the digital twin. What is that exactly?
Data brokers aren't just looking at a spreadsheet with your name on it, they aggregate thousands of data points, your browsing history, your location data, your credit card transactions, and they construct a virtual clone of you.
So they run simulations on my clone. They see that my digital twin recently dropped $20,000 on a car.
They see what specific YouTube videos your twin watches to relax.
And they use that to predict exactly how the real me will behave when I'm tired, stressed, and trying to book a hotel room.
Precisely. And the corporate motivation driving this architecture is staggering. This isn't an experimental side project for these companies.
Because it works.
It really does. Management consulting giants like McKinsey openly advertise to their retail clients that implementing personalized pricing algorithms can generate between 2 and 7 percentage points of sustained margin improvement.
In just a matter of months. I mean, for a large corporation, a 7% margin improvement is billions of dollars.
Exactly. They are literally weaponizing our own digital footprints against our wallets.
So the natural next question is, if this technological arms race is so profitable and consumers are completely outgunned, what is the government doing about it?
We are finally starting to see the first waves of regulatory pushback.
Yeah.
There is definitely rising political scrutiny.
And just to be clear, we are simply reporting on the proposed bills here, not taking any political sides.
Absolutely. Lawmakers across the spectrum, like Representative Greg Sauzer, Senator Ruben Gallego, and Assemblymember Emerita Torres, have been publicly demanding answers from corporations and proposing federal bills.
But the most tangible, concrete action we've seen so far is at the state level, specifically in Maryland.
Yes, Maryland recently passed House Bill 895, known as the Protection from Predatory Pricing Act.
Why is that one so important?
It is historically significant because it is the very first state law in the nation designed specifically to ban surveillance pricing.
Let's look closely at the mechanics of this law, though, because it is very specific. It primarily targets large food retailers, meaning grocery stores over 15,000 square feet and third-party delivery apps.
Right. And it explicitly makes it illegal for them to use a consumer's personal data to set a higher price for a good or service.
And first-time violations can result in fines up to $10,000.
On paper, that sounds like a huge victory for consumer rights.
But
an analysis by Grace Getty at Consumer Reports highlights some incredibly wide loopholes woven into the text.
Yeah, the law completely exempts customer loyalty programs. It exempts subscription services. And it explicitly protects the kind of broad location-based dynamic pricing we talked about earlier, which is wild. Why write a law banning personalized pricing, but then leave a back door open for loyalty programs, which are literally the primary way grocery stores collect personal data?
It comes down to two things: corporate lobbying and the genuine mechanical difficulty of legally defining an algorithm.
Okay, the lobbying part makes sense.
Yeah. Grocery chains fought hard to protect their loyalty programs because those are incredibly lucrative data harvesting tools.
Mm.
But lawmakers are also walking a dangerous tightrope.
How so?
If you write a heavy-handed law that blanketly bans any use of personal data in pricing, you risk outlawing systems that actually help people.
Wait, how does surveillance pricing help anyone?
Well, consider a hospital billing department or a municipal utility company. Many of them use algorithms and consumer data to automatically detect if an individual is lower income or currently struggling with mounting medical debt. The system uses that data to proactively offer them a discounted rate or a manageable payment plan. If a state bans the use of personal data to alter prices entirely, they accidentally make that kind of algorithmic assistance illegal too.
Wow. I hadn't considered that. So you have to define predatory legally, which is incredibly tricky when the math itself is neutral.
Exactly. And that explains another strange quirk of the Maryland law.
The part about lawsuits.
Yeah. As a consumer in Maryland, if you catch a delivery app upcharging you based on your data, you cannot sue them yourself. The law does not grant a private right of action.
Only the state attorney general can bring a lawsuit.
That is a classic legislative compromise. They restrict lawsuits to the attorney general to prevent a flood of frivolous class action lawsuits that could bankrupt local businesses over minor algorithmic errors.
But it also means the enforcement of the law is entirely dependent on the political will and the budget of one single government office.
Furthermore, even if the attorney general decides to act, they have to give the company a 45-day written notice to fix the problem before any legal penalties apply.
So it is a very cautious first step. And frankly, the glaring irony for you tomorrow when you go to the store is that this groundbreaking privacy law might protect you from paying an extra dollar for a gallon of milk.
But it does absolutely nothing to stop a $230 surge on a flight.
Or an Uber algorithm testing your patience when your phone is dying.
Which means, for the foreseeable future, the responsibility of defending your wallet falls entirely on you. The era of blind trust in digital storefronts is officially over.
So practically speaking, how do you change your behavior? We know clearing cookies isn't a magic wand for airfare, but you do have to start comparison shopping against yourself.
Oh, you really do. The new normal requires a much more defensive posture.
Like what? Using burner accounts.
Exactly. If you are booking something expensive, use a burner account that doesn't have your purchase history attached to it. browse in incognito tabs.
And cross-check prices, right?
Yeah. Cross-check the price of a hotel room on your laptop while connected to your home Wi-Fi, and then look at the exact same room on your phone using cellular data.
Force the algorithm to look at you from two different angles to see if the price changes.
It definitely adds friction to your life, but it disrupts the creation of that digital twin.
But I want to leave everyone with a final lingering thought from that Harvard Law piece, because it points to where this is all heading.
It really does.
We are currently focused on the algorithms tracking us today, but the technology is evolving exponentially faster than the law.
As it always does.
Within the next few years, as artificial intelligence becomes deeply integrated into our lives, many of us won't even be doing our own online shopping. We'll use personal AI assistant.
You will simply tell your chatbot to go find you a flight or secure a new television.
And it will go out into the digital marketplace for you.
Yeah.
But think about the underlying mechanics of that transaction. If your personal AI knows your most intimate secrets, your income, and exactly how desperate you are for a vacation, and it goes out to negotiate with a retailer's AI,
whose side is your AI really on when it sets that final price?
Exactly. It's a chilling prospect to mull over.
It suggests that information inequality is going to move from something we interact with directly to a silent, automated negotiation happening entirely behind our backs.
Keep questioning the digital world around you. Stay curious. And thanks for joining us on this deep dive.